Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and part two of our fascinating interview with 100-year-old Navy veteran Bill DeGeneres. As a corpsman serving with the Marines in the Pacific, he knew all about amphibious assault, but he would also get a little education in amphibian animals on Guam.
They sent me out one time on an aid station not too far from where there was a group of Marines. They were doing just that, trying to stop any Japanese invasion. And me and another guy sat out there. They gave us a Coleman lantern, and we was in a pyramidal tent. Maybe not a lot of people know it, but Guam has got a lot of frogs on it. We sat out there with a lamp glowing at nighttime. These frogs would come attracted by the light, beep, 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 you know, like. So I had a gallon of alcohol, which I carried for medicinal purposes. And so we'd ball up some cotton balls and dip them in alcohol and throw it out there. And after a while, we had a lot of drunk frogs sitting around. That was our entertainment. So that only happened a couple of times. But then there was an animal a couple of times. They had stray cattle out there, too. And that kind of excited us one night, hear all this noise, what's happening? And we couldn't see it. But it found out it was just some cattle was moving around and wanted to know what we were doing out there. So that was not a bad experience, but, you know, something to do.
I got to say, that's a first. I've never had a veteran tell me about drunken frogs before. So you learn something every day. And you're able to laugh about all this now. And I can tell that the tone of all your memories, you're clearly thankful to still be going strong at age 100, thankful that you came home. But at the time, I have to imagine that this was tense. This had to be scary at times. Is there a moment maybe that you look back on and you say, you know, that was probably my closest call. It really could have been my number in that circumstance?
Not really. We, even on the patrol, they'd always stick the corpsman right at the back end of the line of the patrol. And I always had to watch over my shoulder because that's what the Japs would do. They would be in these round holes. They'd just stand there and wait for the troops to go by and pop up and shoot them, you know. And that's what I was always afraid of. But it didn't happen. It did happen several times that I've heard of but not know of. No.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stories out there. And my grandfather was in the medical corps in Europe, got a Silver Star, and he had the Red Cross on his helmet. And there were different times where he was told, well, they're actually shooting at you if they had that Red Cross, even though they weren't supposed to. And I've heard stories of some of the Marine Corps battles, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, where corpsmen were specifically targeted because the Japanese knew that would increase the casualties.
I don't know. Later on in the campaign in the Pacific, after Guadalcanal, they learned real quick at Guadalcanal, don't put a Red Cross on your shoulder because you were a target right then. And so the corpsman never put it on. In fact, we didn't carry it. Any time I went out, patrol duty or anything, no Red Cross. And so that was the extent of anything happening to me. I was never in danger as far as I can remember because I wasn't shot at.
Other than the time, you know, Washing Machine Charlie came by and dropped bombs or the cannon fire when you're coming into Guam or the sniper when you're, I mean, you say you weren't shot at, but most of us haven't experienced those things you just told us.
No, there's only one time I remember that there was a lot of shooting, but I was staying pretty low at the time, and that was when I was on Bougainville. And we were close to the beach, and there was snipers that come through once in a while. And we were always on guard at nighttime, because that's when the Japs would try to locate us and fire on us. And that's all I remember. I was seeing tracers, you know, nothing really happened. In fact, there's one time we were sent over to another beach, our whole company. They told us to dig in along the beach. They were expecting boatloads of Japanese to come in for an invasion. So we spent all night long watching the water, and nothing ever happened. But that was kind of an exciting place. I didn't sleep much that night.
Well, you answered my question there about whether you were able to sleep. And so you were still out there in the Pacific when Japan eventually surrendered?
Yeah. In fact, that was after I came home from the Pacific from the Marines.
Okay.
On Guam, I got my orders. It was 26 months I'd been out there then. And so I got my orders to go back to the States. I did my tour of duty in the Pacific. I'm darn lucky I got it then, because my company were starting to pack up. They had orders for the next invasion. And they packed up, and I found out later it was all 3rd Marine Division and a couple other Marine divisions that went into Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. So they had a pretty rough time from then on. And I missed that. But from there I went back to Pearl, and then I caught another ship and went back into Mare Island. And I got orders to meet with another company at the San Diego, Coronado Island. Uh-huh. We had, I forget the name of the ships were down there, but they were all Marine ships. Like, it was an LST I was assigned to. I was the only medical personnel on that ship. Mm. But after I landed in Mare Island, and they gave me orders to appear to the fleet down in San Diego. The amphibious fleet is down below. But that was after I had given 2 weeks leave after we landed in Mare Island, sent me on a train down to my home, to L.A., mm-hmm. and I spent 2 weeks spending a lot of money that I wanted to do something after I've been in the islands all that time. Yeah. But anyway, that was, I stayed with Mom and Dad was still overseas then. Then I had to go down to the amphibious training base. That was it.
Okay.
And caught this LSM. They needed a corpsman because the corpsman had something happened. He had a tour of duty, and he had left. So they needed a corpsman right away because they were leaving the next morning. So that night I had to take my sea bag and everything. That was right after I had my vacation. That night I loaded aboard the LST. The skipper, which was a JG lieutenant, he had another lieutenant with him, which was a navigator. They introduced me to the crew, which was a crew of 10 or 12 men, something like that. And we loaded aboard. They gave me a stateroom. An LSM is like an LST. It's a tanker where they have a deck. All the way back, they have the big doors that open to the ocean at the bow, and on both sides is where they have the compartments for personnel on either side. And I had my room was right next to my first aid station, and that's where I set up my clinic right there. But they introduced me that night, and we went in, packed up, unpacked, and got ready. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, we shoved off. That was really quick. So we went from there. I never was exactly sure what that ship was used for, but it was mainly, we took a lot of supplies out to, we stopped in Pearl, and we stayed there for, two or three days, and loaded up some more supplies. And from there we went out to Marcus Island. I don't know if you ever heard of Marcus Island, which was close to Japan, and we unloaded supplies out there, and I met a world-famous World War boxer, Jim Braddock. I met Jim Braddock out there. Uh-huh. He had a crew of Americans, and they were doing loading. That was an unloading crew. That's what they were. And some guy said, "That's Jim Braddock out there." I said, "What? Okay, I knew of him." So I got his autograph, went over and got his autograph. But that was the extent of what we actually did. After that, we was heading back, I guess, back to Pearl. We got news that the Japanese had surrendered. We were out in the middle of the Pacific, and I think we went down to Eniwetok. I think it was Eniwetok. We went in there, went into the bay in there. And that night, you never saw so many fireworks in your life. It was, we had to, they told us, be careful. There's going to be stuff dropping around, you know. But nothing happened. So from there, we went to Pearl, and that's what was, and I was, went ashore. I was discharged from that boat, that ship. The LSNs were pretty nice. They were a nice ship, but they were, I don't know if you know, an LST is about two-thirds longer than that, just a bigger ship in contrast. But I got off from there at Pearl, and I spent a few days from there, and I caught another ship, and we went to San Diego, and I got discharged there.
When you mentioned Jim Braddock, I'm sure you've seen the movie they made about him, right? Cinderella Man with Russell Crowe. Did you ever see that?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that.
Well, you'll have to see that. It's a pretty good film. I think it won some awards. Cinderella Man, it's called. So when you get home, I mean, here you've spent the last 4 years in the military. You've seen half the world. You've seen all these things. Was it hard to get on with life, or was that an easy transition for you?
Actually, I was glad to get out of the service. I had enough of militarization, do this or do that, shut up and move and don't cry and shut up, you know. Yeah. And I had a lot of friends in the service. And in fact, a couple of years, I heard from one guy, especially which was a Marine, and he went back to Oregon, to Portland. He lived in Portland, and I heard from him for a while. And he told me he went to Iwo Jima, in fact, after I left. When Guam was packing up, they packed up and joined a couple other divisions and went back there. And I forgot to mention that when I was moving around after Guam and after I got that LSM, I contacted him through mail, and I found out that he had a pretty rough time on Iwo Jima, but he lived through it, and he told me about what happened. You know, they lost a lot of Marines. They were one of the worst battles in the Marines ever had, something like 6,000, I think.
Yeah, 6,800 killed and close to 20,000 wounded, and I was going to ask you about that because you made it clear if your time wasn't up, if it wasn't your time to come back to the States, you would have been there too. Were there some guys that you knew that ended up getting wounded or killed there?
No, because we didn't stop on the island. I knew my outfit was still on Guam, where they were setting up a permanent camp for the Marines there. But I didn't know anything about what happened at Iwo Jima until he told me about it. And that was after we got to the sea. He came down and visited me one time, too, from Portland.
You also mentioning some of these famous people you met along the way, like the boxer Jim Braddock and so many of the celebrities of that era, the movie stars, the athletes, they were all in the service somewhere. But you also got to see one of the most famous aces of all time. You saw Dick Bong's P-38 flying away?
That's what I was told, but yeah. I never saw him. But there was several P-38s that flew out of the after they took it over from the Japs. And that's all I know about it. I read about it and I heard about it, that they were flying, and I thought, well, I'm sure Bong was one of those planes. In fact, he was in a group of that group that later on shot down this famous Japanese general. There was a group of P-38s that they found out after they'd cracked the Japanese code, they found out that this general and his plane, I've seen gun camera pictorials of that.
Admiral Yamamoto.
Yamamoto, that's the one.
I'm also wondering, since you told us your story about where you were on VJ Day and the fireworks and all the party, and I don't know the answer to this, do you think those atomic bombs and the way they curtailed the war made a difference in whether or not you lived or died? Would you have been sent to that invasion of Japan?
I think without a doubt. Without a doubt, because as terrible and horrible as the two bombs were, they stopped all hostilities, anything like that, which is, if it hadn't happened, somebody had to go into Japan, and that would be a huge undertaking. It would be all the Army and Navy and Marines that they could get to take over that island, because they were preparing for us to go in there. You know, close to that, Okinawa had a very rough time because that was the South Island to go into Japan. They had to, we had already taken that, and I had a friend that came back from that, and he was half nuts when he came back because it was a lot of cave fighting, and that's where he didn't get hit, but he was kind of a neurotic after that. But yes, I'm sure I would have been. I would have to stay in after the war, but my tour of duty was what they called a kiddie car cruise at 17 till the end of hostilities. That's what I was enlisted for. So at the end of the war, I was a free man. That's why after Guam, I was sent back to the States to be discharged because my tour of duty was over. But I'm here because of two bombs.
That is something I wanted to ask you about, but it's time for our final break. We'll get Bill's perspective on the atomic bomb when we come back. Also, his honor flight experience and his artwork, including the space shuttle painting of his that's in the Smithsonian. You can find a video of Bill and that particular work online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.